Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the news from high tech and from housing, our series, We Used to Be China, and the scent of this radio program. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 17th of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There is, of course, global news, not of the business or economic kind, and so not for us right now. We will instead begin where our brief picks up, which is today in Redmond, Washington. Microsoft said this morning it's going to let go of 14% of its workforce, 18,000 workers all told over the next year, by far the biggest layoff in that company's history. Culture, the business experts will tell you, trumps corporate strategy every single time. So what happens in a culture when massive layoffs arrive in what is a notoriously layoff-averse company? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Laying people off used to be part of Sarah Grant's job.
I hated it. First time I did it, I cried like a baby after it was over.
Grant used to work in HR on Wall Street. Now she's a professor at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. She says the best thing Microsoft can do is be as clear as possible about when layoffs will happen and when announcements will come. Otherwise, panic and rumors can take over.
And, of course, everybody's going to think the worst. Everybody will think that they're the ones going to be laid off.
Microsoft said it's moving now to eliminate 13,000 of the 18,000 jobs it plans to cut. The remaining 5,000 cuts will be announced over the next 6 months. That's going to be a tough half year, says Stanford professor Robert Sutton.
That period of uncertainty and confusion tends to be the biggest problem. So that's what management needs to deal with, because this is the period of time where it's going to be, frankly, the period of hell, but you know when it ends.
Sutton says how a company handles layoffs can play a big role in its future.
The research is actually that when management provides unpredictability, they do a good job of communicating why this was necessary. They give people some control over how the process happens, and they show some compassion that the negative effects on the culture are actually much reduced.
The most important thing for Microsoft? Sticking to its timetable, says Sutton. He says the worst thing the company could do for morale and productivity is to drag out these layoffs. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
This morning, the Census Bureau issued its monthly report on housing starts, that is, actual construction projects begun. They were down more than 9%, which is a lot, and which might also make you ask, hello, what happened to the housing recovery? Which is a fair question, but remember this, it's a big country with a big housing market that varies from region to region. Housing starts actually rose in most places, except down south, where they fell and fell hard. Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains what's going on.
The experts I talked with weren't sure. This is a big drop. Dave Ellis is executive vice president of the Greater Atlanta Home Builders Association.
I think some of us are still scratching our heads trying to get our thoughts around what that really means.
One guess, building lots are harder to come by than they were in the wake of the financial crisis. For a while, banks had a big supply of land that had been poised for development.
The lots were more or less ready to go. Now, in most markets, those lots have pretty much gotten worked through, and they're beginning to develop land again.
Which leads to Brad Hunter's point. He's chief economist for Metro Study, a housing market research company. He thinks North Carolina's harsh winter got in the way of development, the work that needs to happen before you start building a new subdivision.
You have to actually create the backbone of the subdivision, pave in the roads, put in the electric and water, all that infrastructure. So that is what really got slowed down during the winter.
David Crow is chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. He thinks the big issue is a shortage of labor more than land, especially in Texas and Oklahoma, where the energy industries, oil and gas, are taking every available worker. He talked to home builders there.
They are just having an awful time getting labor, and Texas is a big state anyway, and so movements in that state would affect the totals for the whole South.
So, bad news, fewer housing starts, sounds like good news from another perspective. Lots of jobs. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
That non-business and economic news I was talking about sure did a number on Wall Street today. Always interesting how that happens. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Earlier this month, a small city in Southern California became part of the angry debate over migrant children from Central America. In Murrieta, a couple hours southeast of Los Angeles, a couple of hundred people demonstrated outside of a Border Patrol station that was set to receive a busload of undocumented women and children. The protests forced the buses to turn around, and Murrieta found itself the subject of op-eds and tweets and even a cartoon strip, all of them calling it a place of intolerance and hatred. Murrieta's reputation and its business environment has taken a hit. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King reports.
If you look online for Murrieta, California, this is what you find. Footage of demonstrators and counter-demonstrators chanting, waving American flags, and in at least one case, spitting on each other. But if you go to Murrieta, you also see this.
Congratulations, 3, 2, 1, cut that ribbon!
The Murrieta Chamber of Commerce is welcoming Mariscos Las Palmas, a family-owned Mexican restaurant.
Speech, speech! Tell us about yourselves.
About 30 business owners feast on ceviche and tostadas in the restaurant's parking lot. Efraín Buenrostro Barajas, the owner, won't talk about the demonstrations. His son, Norbert Buenrostro, explains why.
He just doesn't want to send the wrong message to people, to customers, you know, thinking that he's for it or against it or whatever. He is an immigrant, but we just choose not to talk about it because it's so sensitive.
That's the attitude of many business owners here. Stay out of the fray, promote a positive image of the city. But John Husing, an economist who studies the region where Murrieta is located, says behind closed doors, he's hearing something else from area business owners.
They're looking at this as an absolute embarrassment for Murrieta. The best statement I heard made was, you really don't want to be in a place where people are spitting on each other. This was not good for business.
Murrieta is a relatively affluent city of just over 100,000 people. The Chamber of Commerce is aggressively trying to attract new jobs. Chamber President Patrick Ellis.
It's always a concern when you have something like this that kind of paints a black eye, per se, on a city. And you have to just do the best you can to, you know, get through it.
We've got tons of water and Gatorade.
11 days after the protests started, only a handful of people are left sitting under tarps outside the Border Patrol station.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be out here for a few hours, so I'll keep you posted.
They have signs that say, Congress, secure the border, and immigrate legally. John Henry, who is so keen to prove he's from Murrieta that he displays his driver's license, said he is worried about the immigrants.
I'm out here today to show support for the Border Patrol guys and to also let the federal government know that we're not going to let them use our small town as a refugee camp and that they're treating these people incorrectly. They need to be brought to a facility that can properly help them.
Henry thinks the message of what he calls the rallies has been distorted. He says things turned ugly in early July thanks to outsiders coming into town. He's sympathetic to business owners' concerns, but he has his own economic worries.
The majority of the people in this area, if you look at the demographics that are unemployed, are white males ages 18 to 32.
People like you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, finding work around here is very hard, especially when we have thousands of people migrating through this area.
For now, the buses have stopped coming into Murrieta. Pitched immigration protests have sprung up in places like Oracle, Arizona, another town that may have to start thinking about its reputation. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
If the e-book readers among you were fast enough yesterday, you might have noticed Amazon seems to be getting ready to launch an e-book subscription service. A page on its website saying basically that was put up and then quickly taken down again yesterday. It'd be called Kindle Unlimited and would give subscribers access to about 600,000 books for just about $10 a month. Subscription models like that work pretty well for movies. For ebooks, though, here's Sally Herships.
First of all, there's nothing new about a book subscription service. Remember Book of the Month Club? But lately, the subscription model has gotten popular again.
There has been a rush of subscription commerce items covering everything from Dollar Shave Club offering cheap razors through to subscription underwear.
Dan Cryan is a digital media analyst with IHS. He says the subscription model makes sense for some consumers.
Certain products like diapers, there's obviously a high quantity of demand needed on a very regular basis. For other goods, it's less clear that you need new items quite so regularly.
Scribd.com, which offers an e-reader subscription service like Amazon's, says its deals with publishers mostly make older titles available, but many readers want the newest ones. Jim Milliot is editorial director of Publishers Weekly. He says that's exactly why publishers are reluctant to give subscribers access to their new releases.
Instead of going out and buying the new John Grisham, maybe they would wait for it to come up as part of a subscription service.
But there's a plot twist. Michael Norris is a media industry consultant. He says Amazon's new service actually has nothing to do with books.
Everything a company like Amazon does has to do with making their close customers even closer.
Norris says, remember, Amazon doesn't have to sell books to stay alive. A subscription service just means another reason consumers would have to stick around its website and hopefully spend more money. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the best way we can tell we're being successful is when the scent is not being delivered and people miss it.
Question: what does your favorite store smell like? Think about it while we do the numbers. The plane crash in Ukraine and the Israeli invasion of Gaza had investors spooked today. The Dow Industrials dropped 161 points, nearly 1%. Closed at 16,976. The Nasdaq crumbled 62 points, 1.4%, ended things at 43.63. The S&P 500 plowed down 23 points, about 1.25%, ended things at 19.58. Morgan Stanley produced some good earnings results, but it wasn't enough to keep investors happy, and the stock fell 0.67%. Microsoft got a nod of approval from investors after it said it's going to lay off 14% of its workforce. As we told you, shares up 1% today. Bond prices soared as investors sought safety in government debt. The yield on the 10-year T-note tumbled to 2.44%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary July consumer sentiment survey. The third annual Kids State Dinner takes place at the White House. The young guests submitted the winning recipes in a contest, the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge. And the late gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson was born on July 18, 1937. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've been talking this week about how the United States solved, or at least reduced, I guess you should say, some of its biggest air pollution problems and what China can learn from that experience as it chokes on its own pollution. It's a series we're calling We Used to Be China. So with that, here is something you don't hear much about these days. But back a while ago, before global warming, before the hole in the ozone layer, there was acid rain. And you know what? We did something about it. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has that story.
When I was growing up in the 80s, acid rain was a really big deal. We wrote school reports about it, watched cartoons about it, like this Captain Planet episode called, naturally, Rain of Terror.
What's so bad about burning a little coal?
Many things. One of the worst is that it creates acid rain.
By the 80s, we knew Midwest power plants spewed tons of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides into the atmosphere. The chemical reactions turned rain and snow into killers. It seemed intractable. This was the show Nova in 1984.
We've seen lakes acidify and die because of acid rain.
Now we shall in all probability have to add destruction of forests.
It was particularly bad in upstate New York, in the Adirondack Mountains. On NOVA, Sue Capone, a biologist with the Adirondack Lake Survey Corporation, is out taking water samples.
Look out.
30 years later, I find Sue Capone is still out there. She's field operations supervisor now.
You want things to be as consistent as possible as you, when you take your sample.
Are you surprised by how much things have changed since the 80s?
Actually, I am. Recently.
Now when she hikes miles or flies to take samples in remote lakes, she finds a rebirth.
So I can see a little fish even in there right now. A little minnow.
Many of the lakes that had turned crystal clear and lifeless in the 70s and 80s are again stocked with fish. A record brook trout was caught in one. pH levels, a measurement of how acidic something is, are improving. It's promising progress, a half century since a young scientist first noticed something was odd about rain.
It was a great surprise. It was one of those aha moments. What is this and why is it like that?
Gene Likens was a professor at Dartmouth in 1963, starting a project to take what he calls the vital signs of a forest in New Hampshire. He wanted to measure the ecosystem's chemistry. After a storm, he was shocked to find the rain was nearly as acidic as vinegar.
We didn't know how acid rain should be. We certainly weren't thinking about acid rain.
This was about to become his life's work. He and his team had to start from scratch, flying to the most remote places on Earth, like the southern tips of South America and Africa, to measure the acidity of unaffected rain. As evidence mounted that power plant emissions were the culprit in the U.S., he had to build a case against skeptical utility owners.
No, it's not going up my smokestack. No, it's not what went up my smokestack didn't come down on your forests in New Hampshire.
He and his team would even follow smokestack plumes in small planes to see where they blew. It took nearly a decade, but by 1972, they were ready to tell the world, publishing their first academic paper.
And we thought long and hard before we wrote that paper about what the title should be.
In the end, they went with acid rain, which turned out to be a brilliant label.
The idea that you could sing in the rain, you could walk in the rain, and then the rain was acid, really kind of grabbed people. So it had that impact on branding, if you will.
I'm singing in the rain.
Acid rain was soon big news.
I had phone calls from literally all over the world, scientists saying, what is going on? What is all this about?
Hundreds joined the research effort. In the 70s and 80s, politicians vowed to study it more. It became an issue of region versus region, with the Midwest power plants and coal mines against the Northeast and its suffering lakes and forests. Then, a new Clean Air Act in 1990 started turning things around. Utilities spent upwards of $1 billion to install high-tech scrubbers on smokestacks or switch to lower sulfur coal from out west. That new coal was a boon to railroads in mining states like Wyoming. Now power plant emissions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides have been cut more than 70%.
This is kind of the war room for 1980. These have been up there since 1983.
Karen Roy is head of the Adirondack Long-Term Monitoring Program. She's in a basement conference room that's more like a museum. Pins are stuck in a wall-sized map of the region, marking all the lakes they've been testing the past 3 decades.
Would I have predicted that we could have turned this around as a nation? No. I would not. There were just too many other things that seemed to get in the way.
Roy and Likens are not ready to declare victory. Not all the lakes are back. Forest ecosystems will take much longer to recover. But things are so improved that for the first time, Roy is considering scaling back her team's monitoring. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, how acid rain was taken care of by one of the most successful environmental deals ever. A little thing you might have heard of, it's called cap and trade. You can hear all of our series, We Used to Be China, online. We've got stories, a wild slideshow, a pollution timeline, and the pictures of air, dirty and otherwise, that you all have sent us this week. It's at marketplace.org. Think for a second about walking into your favorite store. Visualize the lighting, the background music, and the color on the walls. What you might not notice, consciously at least, is the smell of the place. But you can bet for the people who run those stores, the ones who are thinking about branding and how to get you to spend more time and money there, scent is pretty important. Andy Kindfuller is the CEO of Scent Air. That is a company that works with different brands to come up with those signature scents for their spaces. And yes, it is indeed a real business. Andy, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Cinnabon, I get. Toll House Cookies, I get. Even the Cheesecake Factory, even though they serve much more than cheesecake, I get all that. But talk to me for a second about, I don't know, Abercrombie & Fitch, Nordstrom.
Well, they're wonderful retail brands we're working with. Let's talk about Hugo Boss, because Hugo Boss...
High-end clothing, right?
High-end clothing, and what CEOs and CMOs of those type of high-end or mass market retailers realize is that if they don't connect and make it a comfortable, welcoming place to shop and to spend their money, consumers will go somewhere else. So we work with those type of brand owners to create a scent that matches the brand attributes of those brands and makes consumers happy to be in there spending their money.
All right, tell me how you make a smell that matches the brand attributes of Hugo Boss.
Well, we work almost like an advertising agency. And what you need to do is you understand, you actually often get their brand book and you work with their marketing team. And then we have a very large fragrance development team that actually matches those attributes.
Oh, you have to walk me through that. A fragrance development team matching brand attributes. How does that work? Do you guys sit in a room with a big whiteboard and spitball it?
Yes, we actually do. And I'll tell you, at some point, if you're ready, we can actually, we've done that with Marketplace.
Well, now
you're
stealing my thunder. I was going to roll that out in a minute. But all right, let's do that. So our producers got a hold of you as we were setting up this interview and said, listen, let's get some brand things going here. So I guess I filled out a questionnaire. Some other people filled out a questionnaire about what we think Marketplace is like and how we want to be perceived. And you put together a very nicely branded, I must say, little packet for us. And we have Scent Air fragrance selections right here. I'm opening it up, as you can hear.
Great.
And we have, and look at all those.
First, I want to ask you, Kai, what do you think are the brand attributes of Marketplace? When you think of your listeners, if you were to have a retail space, what are some of the things, the terms that would come to mind of your listeners?
Okay, so we are welcoming, we are accessible, we can be fun and funny at the same time, we are deeply informative, we are relevant, and we are engaged and engaging. Listen to me talk. How about that?
I'll tell you what's nice. And this is the exciting thing about working with brands, is that your definition matched what a lot of folks said.
Oh,
engaged,
good.
Trusted, stimulated, energized, happy, and then a little bit edgy. What's nice about Marketplace is you're not just your old grandfather's news. And so what we've done is created two scents.
Okay.
And if you can smell Marketplace one, and I apologize to all your listeners that we can't allow them this wonderful experience right now.
So I should tell folks what we have here. I have a small cardboard box. It's thin and wide, and it's foam packed, and it's got eight of these tiny vials in them, we should say, and it's got those paper tester things you do with perfumes
at the
stores. Blotters is what they're called. All right. So I'm opening Marketplace One. It is a yellowish, straw-ish colored liquid, if that makes any difference. And here we go. I'm dipping the blotter now. So I dip it in, and what do I do? Wave it around?
You want to gently wave it in front of your nose. In the real world, we have systems, proprietary systems, that go from very small point of purchase up to stadiums. We do the Dallas Cowboys Stadium, the St. Louis Rams.
Seriously? What does Dallas Cowboys Stadium smell like other than, I don't know, sweat and cheerleaders?
And victory.
Okay.
I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, so I don't know about that. But it smells good, and we want to, when we work with our customers, you want to create an environment where people stay.
All right. I have dipped into Marketplace One. I'm wafting it around gently in front of my nose. Crisp, I will say.
Perfect.
All right. What else? You have the specs there in front of you. Tell me what I'm smelling.
So this is a nuanced scent that has a bunch of different ingredients, including crisp white tea, hints of green tea, and fig. We felt that it matched the bright, vibrant blend of what is the Marketplace brand.
Yep. I'll give you all that. It may be a tad too floral for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all right.
Yes. And so here's the challenge, because some of the floral creates the invigorating, fun notes that you're looking for.
Yep.
We think Marketplace 2 might actually match your brand even better.
Marketplace
so
2.
Marketplace 2 has black tea, seagrass, cypress, amber. It's a little more, a little bit heavier.
Ooh, it's a little muskier, a little duskier this one is,
exactly. It's warmer. It's richer. You might detect a soft citrus note there.
Mm-hmm.
And the perfumers that we use use up to 10,000 different ingredients. And what's amazing is they can identify those 10,000 just by smell. Mm-hmm. And so we will often create a fragrance that can have several hundred different notes.
How, I guess, do you know that you've got it right? Do you have somebody, do you have the CEO of Hugo Boss sitting there saying, yes, this is it, no, it isn't it?
Absolutely. The best way we can tell we're being successful is when the scent is not being delivered and people miss it. They say, I feel like there's something not in the store. And there's lots of studies, by the way, lots of scientific research. People stay longer in a store that's scented. They feel more comfortable and more connected with the brand.
Do you do other spaces, I guess, right? I can think of like apartment buildings or hotels. You must do that as well, not just retailers.
Absolutely. Or medical, health, dental clinics. There's lots of research.
Well,
people. Sure. Well, think about it. If you're going in for testing and your heart rate is rised and you're feeling nervous, if you are coming into a warm and welcoming environment, you're going to feel better about that appointment.
Do you have a favorite smell besides like chocolate chip cookies in your mom's kitchen?
I just love the sense of smell, and so I don't have a particular favor. It's like a mother. They're all my children.
Yeah, there you go. Andy Kindfuller, he is the CEO of Scent Air Technologies. They were kind enough to give us a scent identity, which somehow we're going to have to figure out a way to share with you guys out there. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Tell you what, we did our best to give you an idea of what those marketplace scents smell like at our website. And while you are online, take a minute to tell us what you think marketplace smells like. And get us on Twitter, at Marketplace, also on Facebook. You can get me, if you don't get too personal, at Kai Rizdahl.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which social science does what it so often does, proves for us that which we already knew deep, deep in our souls. In this case, that Facebook is bad for us. In the June edition of the journal Computers and Human Behavior, actual peer-reviewed studies of that thesis, the first showed that the longer people are on Facebook, the worse mood they were in afterward. The second showed that that is in part because being on Facebook leaves people with a feeling, and this is a quote, of not having done anything meaningful. In layman's terms, it's a time suck, you guys. Come on. All right, we're done. We're late, in fact. I got to go. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. Not that late. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.